Please silence all electronic devices.
We've added the court requirements to this. We have drawn these maps without any consideration of partisan data.
I'm not going to be running for re-election, but I will save my bloviating until the end of next year.
As you try to date my granddaughter, I want to recommend that you remember how hard I will fight for liberty. Happy birthday, Liberty Kidwell.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Legislative Press Dungeon on West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. State lawmakers have departed until the end of the month. I guess I believe it. Pretty certain this will be their longest break so far of 2019. So a collective exhale as we review the week in state politics. Here, as usual for the conversation, are Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch and Becky Gray with the conservative John Locke Foundation. Hey there.
Hey there.
Hey, guys.
We have new political maps. Court-ordered legislative redistricting was completed on Tuesday. Three state judges, with the help of a map referee, will now review the new boundaries. It is reasonable to think that the plaintiffs, Common Cause, may very well challenge parts of the new set of districts. Legislators got some credit for largely conducting this condensed redraw in the open and doing so with input from various camps. Lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, have also taken some criticism in recent days, with some of the experts noting that these maps are still partisan and that the Dems prioritized protecting themselves. What is the best and, conversely, the worst part about these new districts? Becky.
I think the best part is the process that we saw go out and how the Republicans and Democrats worked together. All of the hearings were open. I think that's another plus, that there was open. There was time for public comment. All of this was, you could pick it up online. And Jeff, one of the things that I found the most interesting was not the official discussion, the official committee meetings and all, but they had the mics on while the legislators were at the computers going back and forth, and just to kind of listen to the bantering back and forth. And even as controversial as so many things were last week, that process, particularly in the Senate, seemed to be very amenable, you know, between legislators. So, and it seems to me, now, I'm not a lawyer, and I've read the court order. It was a little bit hard for me to follow, again, if every line that they put in there was in compliance with the court order. But it certainly seems to be. And I think the fact that they got that done within the two-week deadline was, you know, kind of amazing, too, that they were able to do that.
And what didn't go well? What was the worst part of it?
I think, to be honest with you, I think the worst part is the second-guessing after the process is, you know, there's been criticism that, well, some of these maps still favor Republicans. Well, the instruction was to draw maps without partisan consideration. If your complaint is they're not Democratic enough, then that's a partisan consideration. So I think, you know, we just can't seem to get away from that, even after this two-week exercise of what I would argue is a very bipartisan cooperative, not considering the partisan and electoral data as they drew those maps.
Well, I agree that it was better than what we've had in the past and that it wasn't completely in secret, but I thought it was lousy for the most part. I think this process proves why this needs to be taken away from lawmakers. Even well-meaning, well-intended lawmakers who want to do the right thing, give me a break. They didn't have partisan objectives in their head. I'm sorry. It's impossible to do that if you were a lawmaker who is looking at a map and trying to figure out what their district that they're going to represent is going forward. The mere fact that they spent oodles of time talking about incumbent protection and double bunking, which basically means protecting their own hides, I mean, shows once and for all definitively that just rules and directives from courts are not enough. We need to take this authority away from legislators. I'm very hopeful that the court will correct some of the overt, I'd say, partisanship that still is infecting these maps. And again, better than what we've had in the past, but if this is all we're going to get out of the great national movement to fight and combat gerrymandering, I'm very disappointed.
To be clear, the court did allow for consideration of incumbency protections.
Right.
Not as though the lawmakers went against the court with that effort there.
It was a question perhaps of degree, but
sure.
Yes.
Yeah. What was the best thing that came out of this?
Well, I said, I mean, it's better than it was.
Okay.
It was sort of in the public eye. I'm not so excited about, maybe you could hear some banter, maybe not. There were things we couldn't hear. There were, you know, people huddled around computers looking at their own districts. To me, I mean, it's great, I guess, that we got to see the sausage made to a little bit of an extent, but it's still pretty coarse, unpleasant sausage.
And one other thing that we saw that I think was really significant from the court order, picking up on the rules and the standards to be adhered to, which actually came from the Stevenson, another redistricting lawsuit that this court picked up and reiterated. So one thing that I think is really positive is we seem to be getting closer to a clear set of rules under which these maps can be drawn.
But we can't draw rules that will that will control what's in the heads of the lawmakers who are making the decisions. And I just think it's human nature, if you are a lawmaker, that you're going to have partisan objectives when you're in there saying, maybe you're saying it's about incumbent protection or double bunking, but it's impossible to disconnect those. And so that's why I would again argue we need to take it away from legislators and legislative staff.
Both y'all's organizations and both of you have long been proponents of independent redistricting. So tell me if, of course, anything has changed on that front. Should lawmakers, and maybe this is just a foolish question on its face, but should lawmakers have any hand in doing maps?
I can't see what it should be. I mean, to me, I really think that an independent commission, it won't be perfect, but it would be vastly better. And there's just a temptation there if you're a legislator that you just can't resist. Again, it's human nature. I'm in there. I'm a lawmaker. I can't help but look out what's best for me in my own reelection, and that just shouldn't go into it. In my estimation, I realize the court maybe says that's not unconstitutional, but in terms of what's good policy, I would argue that's a lousy way to run a railroad.
Well, of course, our Constitution authorizes the General Assembly to draw these maps, so there is that.
Right.
We could have a constitutional amendment to change that, and that's one of the considerations. There's been several bills that have been filed this session,
right.
And you know, at least one of them has a constitutional amendment provision in it. But I think, you know, I mean, let's just be realistic about this. There is no such thing as an independent commission. I mean, if you find, I mean, the proposals that we've seen this, I think that the legislators should draw the maps. Actually, I think there's a bill that has been put forward, House Bill 140, that I think makes the most sense.
And there would be a process. Is that the bill sponsored by Representative Chuck McGrady?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it has strong bipartisan support. It would do really two things. One, it would put those rules that we've mentioned in R. and Stevenson and were in this three-judge judgment that they made, put the rules in the Constitution. So it is clear what those rules are. And it's things like keeping counties whole, one man, one vote, you know, equal population,
right,
contiguous. Yes, exactly.
Sure.
Yeah. That have been adhered to, but they are not embedded in the Constitution. I think it's time to embed those in the Constitution. And then the second thing that this bill does, it sets up a process where the maps would be drawn by legislative staff. And if we learned anything in the last 2 weeks, I think it's that the legislative staff does a good job with this under those clear rules. I mean, again, you've got to have the rules. That's the most important thing. Then it becomes less important who actually draws that. But legislative staff with the review commission and then final approval by the General Assembly. What I like about having the General Assembly do it as well is they're accountable. You know, if you have an independent commission, most people are not even going to know who that is. If your legislator does it, your legislator is up for reelection every 2 years, and that should and ought to be a consideration when you are selecting who you want to represent you.
Well, that's a switch. I guess for a long time, yeah, I thought there was a bipartisan movement amongst progressives and conservatives in this state to start an independent commission to move in that direction. I'm disappointed to hear Becky say that. I think that the idea of turning it over to legislative staff who report to legislators, who are overseen by a very partisan individual who leads the Legislative Services Office, and then creating a structure where the legislature can just we don't want to do that anyway, which is what that bill actually says at the end. They can just dismiss what the recommendations are of the legislative staff. That's no solution to the problem. I agree that the commissions are not 100% perfect, but getting it out of legislative hands, getting it out of the hands of people who are elected to, yes, an anonymous group who people don't even know who they are would be much better, because we've had a system now where people know who their legislators are. They could have voted them out of office. They didn't like what they did.
And have.
But they don't do it because of this. They don't know how to do it because of this. And that's the problem. We've got to take it away from the legislators and put it in an independent place.
I think we need to keep it with the most accountable body that we possibly can, and the body that is closest to the people that are represented in those districts. And that's the General Assembly.
I'm hearing a major shift from you, and maybe
not really.
Okay, I mean my understanding. I mean I'm thinking of Mitch Kokai, a colleague of yours, standing in the press room advocating for independent redistricting.
Independent redistricting is not the same thing as an independent commission.
Okay,
well, you can have
an. Can we agree? And as Rob likes to say, we're slicing the bologna a little thin here.
Right.
But
yeah.
If Dan Blue or Phil Berger. Whoever's in the, Phil mm-hmm. Berger's obviously in the majority right now. If a lawmaker is drawing districts, we can throw the word independence away from this conversation. Can we
not? I think so, yeah. And okay. what this is outlined in House Bill 140, that it would put that map drawing into the hands of the nonpartisan professional legislative staff that, you know, I mean, we could argue, okay, is that better or worse than an independent commission? The map drawing is not actually in the hands of the legislature.
But the bill
but
also says
binding.
That they bill
can,
says
they
that
can
the,
take it away.
The legislature can override them and say they just don't want to do that at the end.
It's up or down.
It would be an up or down vote.
So the General Assembly does not draw the map.
Yeah, they do,
send
actually.
It back.
No,
no
the, after they've
they
discarded
it
twice, they can
take it.
No, I don't believe they've read the bill right. I think at the end, the final decision is with the General Assembly. They can take
and,
it upon
and,
themselves.
And that is who we are accountable to. That is who is accountable to the voters. And I just think
that's
that
where
having
we are now.
I think having that process
so not,
is better. But I am all about, and we are, you know, the Lott Foundation has long advocated for an independent redistricting process. You know, then you get into the question, okay,
yeah,
if we do a commission, who would that be? How would you select those? Would it be half one party and half another? How would you do that?
I don't
There's
know.
There's all kinds of ways to do it.
Well,
I mean,
you know,
it's been,
but,
tried, it's been done successfully
you know, I mean,
in lots of states.
And it's been done unsuccessfully
yeah,
in a lot of places,
definitely.
States
Something
as well.
We'll
so, you know, as you say, you know, the devil's in how thin you slice the bologna. But, you know, I mean, we certainly have to look at that. And there are examples across the state how to do it. But to dismiss completely this notion that's been outlined in 140 that has strong bipartisan support, I think, you know, it's something that we need to have on the table as we discuss this and move forward with it.
Before we move on, we're going to move on to Medicaid, I swear, here in a moment. But independent commission, there are a lot of ways to do it. What is your preferred way
I don't
to
per
do
se
it?
Have one. I think okay. there's been some legislation introduced. I think, in fact, the folks at Common Cause have put forth some legislation. I think we should take a look at that. It'd be nice if we could have actually had some debate about it this year at the General Assembly. They didn't even
might.
Consider
–
well, it's September. It's the middle of September. We should have adjourned 3 months ago.
You think so?
That we'll have a discussion of some kind of redistricting reform before they adjourn? Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do.
Well,
that
presupposes
I do.
That they're
yeah,
actually going
I hope
adjourn.
We do.
Sure
I mean, I think we've certainly teed this up with this court case
sure.
For, you know, for a discussion, and I would hope some substantial reform would be done before they adjourn.
Let's be straight. Art Pope has been intimately involved in developing House Bill 140. He is the person who is one of the brains behind the conservative movement in the state. He's very involved with the development of this legislation. The bill would make his ally, Paul Koble, the head of the Legislative Services Office, the person who would oversee this process.
That is a cheap shot, and
it's
it is
true,
unfair.
Though.
You know who is else? It? You know who else has advocated for this?
Tom
Ross.
I know, and so, I disagree you know, vehemently with Tom on this one.
But you know, to make personal attacks.
It's not a personal attack.
It's
a statement of fact.
Cheap shot.
It's a person who was himself in the middle.
He
of
also
drawing the Republican
in,
maps.
You know, he served in the General Assembly.
I know.
He was
he
on the redistricting commission.
He was a politician. Absolutely.
He was on the redistricting commission. I mean, you know, he's a lawyer. I mean, you know.
But, from a functional standpoint, is anything that Rob just said unfair? I mean.
I think it's a cheap shot.
But not unfair.
I think it's unfair.
It's certainly
why?
True.
Because I don't know why you bring personalities into this. And it's clear what Rob thinks of Art Pope and the conservative movement. And, you know, I just think it's, you know, let's
well,
talk about
Art
let's
has
talk
an agenda.
About ideas.
I don't blame Art for having an agenda. He has an agenda. That's fine. But we shouldn't pretend like that's not influencing. Just as we can't pretend that lawmakers aren't drawing maps within their brain, how it's going to affect
but
their
to
agenda.
To dismiss an idea that's on
that
the table with personal attacks is why
it's
we can't get anywhere
attack.
With these
it's
discussions.
But let me recenter it for a second. And again, we're going to move on to Medicaid, I promise.
Something non-controversial.
really non-controversial. If we're using the word independence, if that's where mm-hmm. this whole conversation started, in 10 or 11 minutes in here, I hear the name Paul Koble. I've got to swallow a little bit of laughter. I mean, that's one of the most unindependent people in this building. Can we agree that if Paul Koble has his fingertips on the back end of a map, we have, again, kind of thrown the word independence in the trash?
I'm not, I mean, why would you assume that Paul Koble would be the head of legislative services when this goes into effect?
Well, he's if presently we put the head
today.
Of legislative services.
He is
That's
today,
why I'm making that grand
maybe
leap.
He will be next year. Maybe he won't be. I mean, we don't know that. You can't pass transformational reforms thinking that one person may or may not be in charge of it. I mean, you know, we will see another day when Democrats will be in charge of the General Assembly.
And that would be a bad way to do it. I agree. Well, that would be lousy to have the Democrats in charge of it, too.
So, you know, if you make these decisions and something is hyper-partisan, as redistricting is, the whole question is, if you make that based on who's in charge today, you're going to have to live with it when the pendulum swings back the other way. Right. So people that are making these decisions and thinking about these things should make it based on, okay, what if the whole situation were flipped the other way?
Right.
Would this be fair?
And
I would argue that, you know, the idea of having legislative staff, and I will say, and you have made comments about Paul Koble. What is your perception? What is your perception about legislative staff? I mean, in my view,
you all have a lot more experience around here than I do. If you can point to a legislative staffer who is a former elected Republican mayor of Raleigh, has run for federal, state, and local offices as a Republican, married into the Jesse Helms' campaign, I'm all ears. But again, Becky, we're talking about independence.
Right.
And I would absolutely agree that a staff member on its face is going to be,
right.
he or she would be more independent.
Right. And in my experience, they have been.
Officer.
I mean, you know, Jerry Cohen, who you could argue
right,
is very, you know,
here.
Left. But, you know, he was a legislative staffer. But I don't know anybody who is as professional, consistently professional, and true to ideas than Jerry Cohen is. So, you know, just to dismiss this whole thing without any consideration, I just think it's unfair. I think it's short-sighted. And you've got a lot of people in the General Assembly and really smart people who are committed to this thinking about all of these ideas that are on the table.
Were you about to call Jerry Cohen very left-leaning? Was that?
Yes.
Okay.
He's run for political office as a Democrat and been described. Okay. I think he would describe himself as very left-leaning.
I don't know.
I'd have to ask him.
We would have to ask him.
But I wouldn't. I would. I wrote a piece in which I said I think it would be a lousy idea for Jerry Cohen to be in charge of this process, too.
Let's revisit Medicaid. Republican House Speaker Tim Moore said for months that if his chamber overrode the governor's veto, they would then take up a bill to expand the federal health program for people living in poverty and those with disabilities. So after last week's abrupt vote, a House Health Committee turned to Medicaid. Carolina Cares has a work requirement and modest premiums. Federal courts have struck down work requirements in three states, currently standing in Indiana. That's the only state. Public health officials, by and large, contend that premiums are an unnecessary bureaucratic burden. But this is the proposal on the table in a Republican-controlled state. Rob, in the name of compromise and pragmatism and providing access to 500,000 uninsured North Carolinians, if that's truly what this is about, why aren't progressives coalescing around this bill?
Well, I'm not sure that's not true. We haven't had a vote on it. We had a voice vote, I guess, in committee. We had a vote on this a few weeks ago, or maybe now it's been a few months ago in committee. It passed 25-6. I think, you know, in general, progressives think we've got to expand Medicaid. There are thousands of lives at stake. The best way to do it is to do a clean bill, as has been done in most states. Just as you said, these work requirements end up being bureaucratic. They end up costing more than they save. The same is true with these premium requirements. People fall in and out of the working world. They work for 20 hours one week. You know, you can't tell who's connected to the workplace and what's a reasonable amount to charge them. It's a lousy way to do it. But there's no doubt that it would be better to have that than nothing. So, you know, I think if this were actually put to a fair vote, if it were put to a vote on the floor, if Phil Berger got out of the way and we had a vote in the Senate, probably pass, and Governor Cooper would probably grudgingly sign it.
You have not been in favor of Medicaid in virtually any shape or form that I can think of.
Medicaid expansion.
Medicaid expansion. I'm sorry.
Medicaid,
we already have 2 million people who are...
Thank you very much.
Has anything changed for you and Medicaid?
No.
Okay.
I think that, you know, I think that if we can agree that what the problem is that there are many people in North Carolina who cannot afford health insurance because of the rising cost of health care, that the answer to that is not more entitlement programs. The answer to that is to find ways to lower the cost of health care so that people can afford the health insurance that best fits their needs and their families without government dependency. And there's lots of ways to do that, and we've seen some progress. Congress with that this session. The Association Health Plan bill that passed will make have more variety, more competition, make health care plans suitable for individuals, more streamlined kind of things. Direct primary care, more reliance on telemedicine, those kind of things. Expanding the scope of, not the, allowing the scope of practice for mid-level providers to ensure access, to ensure that quality of care. You know, those kind of things are a better way to go about ensuring that people can afford the health insurance that best suits their needs. You know, there are a lot of states that have expanded Medicaid, and so we're able to look and see what is happening in those states and the problems that they've had, and the problems are huge. You know, many states, I met with a representative from Ohio yesterday who said that they had expanded Medicaid and it had been a disaster. It had been a disaster for the budget. Many of the people that Medicaid was designed for are now being crowded out of that program and are not receiving services that they need. So there's all kinds of problems that have occurred in these other states. And I think that, you know, we're still in the middle of a Medicaid transformation here, moving to the managed care model.
Right.
Yeah, we're just starting that. So I think the wise thing to do is, again, to focus on how do we lower the cost of health care? And then let's get our Medicaid program right for those who are entitled to those services and that the program was designed for before we start talking of adding of hundreds of thousands of additional people onto a very fragile program.
I mean, there's a reason that 37 states have expanded Medicaid and not a single one has taken it back, and that's because it works. It's because it saves lives. It's because it enhances their economy. It creates thousands of jobs. Is it a perfect system? Absolutely not. But you know what? Our public schools aren't perfect, but we don't say we're not going to enroll any more kids because the system's going to be fixed. The reality is that Medicaid, health insurance, massive public enterprises like this, human enterprises, will always have bureaucracy. They'll always be imperfect. And if we take the position that we can't expand it, we can't do anything to save lives and add more people until we fix it, it'll never get done. And so I think that's important to keep in mind, that the system that we have now is not perfect, but we know for a fact that we would save thousands of lives if we expanded Medicaid and create thousands of jobs. And it's just, it ought to be a no-brainer. And again, I understand maybe there's a representative from Ohio who thinks it was a mistake in Ohio. That's not what Governor Kasich says, and that's not what the people of Ohio say, where they're very happy that they have expanded, just as they are in the 37 other states that have expanded it.
Perhaps a lighter one to end on comes from Forsyth County, where this week Republican District Attorney Jim O'Neill said that he would support Democratic State Representative Derwin Montgomery, also from Forsyth, if and when Montgomery files a medical marijuana bill. This got me to thinking about bipartisan relationships. Also thought of John Alexander, Republican senator from Wake County, who is not running for re-election next year. He is married to a woman who is a Democrat. I know this not because I know them, because I've seen his campaign videos. So who has the most bipartisan relationship in North Carolina? Or perhaps what's the best bipartisan relationship? What's the best relationship of bipartisanship in North Carolina? We could slice this a couple different ways.
You're talking about a couple or something, or legislators?
It could be just whoever comes to mind. I'll give you one other one, which is Phil Berger and Dan Blue.
Yeah, they seem to get along pretty well. They have a cordial relationship. I don't know. You go first, Becky. I'll have to think about
this. How about me and Rob?
Yeah.
You could. 22 minutes in, we're still talking,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, that's a good one.
We're still talking.
Oh, geez.
And that's not what I was intending to derive out of it. And if there's not another one, we can...
Well, you know, we talked about... Actually, Becky wasn't here last week. We talked about at the end of his life how the late I. Beverly Lake found some bipartisan common ground. I would say, I guess, it's probably one really good example of bipartisanship amongst a lot of people is around the area of criminal justice, where, amazingly, the Koch brothers, who are usually held up as the arch enemies of progressives, have invested lots of money in the idea of reforming our criminal justice system. And all credit to them for that, and to groups like Becky's and others that are working to move us in the direction of away from this sort of punitive, prison-oriented system to a true rehabilitation system that moves us away from, you know, the get-tough-on-drugs crime policy that we had 30 years ago in this country. So maybe there's one little glimmer of hope of an area.
I think there's a lot of glimmer. You know, I really do. We live this every day. We live in this building. You know, Rob and I are about ideas. you know, you're reporting on this stuff every day, Jeff. But I think when you, you know, when you get out in the real world, I mean, you know, it's not all this back and forth and complete difference of opinions on things. You know, another area that we're seeing some real bipartisan cooperation, I think we'll see more, is on the ABC reform and a lot of the things that we've seen there of loosening up some of those regulations to allow the craft brewing industry to grow, mm-hmm. to put some allowances in for the growing craft distillery business to grow, and really looking at reforming the ABC system, questioning whether or not government even needs to be in the liquor business at all. So, you know, there's lots of areas.
And you got a Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote for me? You got a one particular couple or parent that you're like, they don't belong together, but they do pretty well together. And you don't. Okay, that's fine. I mean, there's not a correct answer here.
I'll go back to me and Rob.
Okay, all right.
That sounds good to me. Yeah, I think that we'll have to cipher on that, but I'm sure there's some are escaping me at this moment.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks. You too.
As a radio reminder, you can hear a broadcast version of this conversation each Friday at 4:50 on 91.5 FM throughout the Triangle. Thanks for spending some time in the WUNC Politics podcast feed. Remember, it's a bi-weekly drop now. Long-form conversations will appear earlier in the week. On Tuesday, I spoke with former State Supreme Court Associate Justice Bob Orr. Spoiler, he's engaging and interesting as always, so you should give that a listen when you have a chance. Then, on Fridays, we'll drop this conversation. I call it WISP, Week in State Politics, which is usually with Becky and Rob. Remember to give us a rating and review. I'm told that helps grow the audience. And if there are topics that need more addressing, please let me know. I'm on Twitter at J_Tibbs. You'll hear from me again on Tuesday when I'm joined by Dan Blue, Wake County Democrat and Minority Leader of the North Carolina Senate.